You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Sue Perlgut. Welcome, Sue.
Thank you, Eric.
It is good to have you on the show this morning.
Thank you.
The way we start this is I ask people to answer the question in whatever way you want to, who are you? Where do we need to start this conversation? You're known in the community, so that's going to be a funnier sort of thing. But what's the 2 minute, 3 minute? This is the bold stroke picture of my life.
What's my elevator speech for myself? You know, yeah. I mean, I did look at the questions you sent, and I thought, I'm not going to answer them before I get there. I'm going to answer them on the fly. After all, improvisation is part of what I do.
That's right.
So, who am I? Gosh, the 2 minute elevator speech. Well, I'm a cultural, political activist, feminist, married woman. What's important to me now? I do theater. I make films. I have a fabulous granddaughter. Those are the important things to me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I would say that's who I am. My feminism embraces everything and everybody. Mm-hmm. It's what's key about me.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess, I'm sure I'm leaving things out, but that's really, I'd say that's it.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's a beginning. It's a start.
Yeah.
And you also came with music, and you asked that we start with Joni Mitchell's Court and Spark. Do you want to speak to that now or after?
Well,
we play?
I come out of the 60s and the 70s, and I was always too old for my peer group. I always wanted to do the things younger people were doing.
Uh-huh.
Although I think Court and Spark was really my era. So I've always loved Joni Mitchell. She's a phenomenal poet. What she sings always speaks to me, even though sometimes I don't understand it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
I
mm-hmm.
adore her.
Okay.
Love came to my door with a sleeping roll and a madman's soul. He thought for sure I'd seen him dancing up a river in the dark, looking for a woman to court and spark. He was playing on the sidewalk for passing change when something strange happened. Glory train passed through him, so he buried the coins he made in People's Park and went looking for a woman to court and spark. It seemed like he read my mind. He saw me mistrusting him and still acting kind. He saw how I worried. Sometimes I worry sometimes. All the guilty people, they said they've all seen the stain on their daily bread, on their Christian names. I cleared myself, I sacrificed my blues, and you could complete me, I'd complete you. His eyes were the color of the sand in the sea, and the more he talked to me, the more he reached me. But I couldn't let go of LA, city of the fallen angels.
And And that was Joni Mitchell's Court and Spark. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Sue Perlgut. Sue, you use the word feminism as the way, the how, the what, the wherewithal that you live. How did you come to that, and what do you mean by that?
It's interesting. I was looking at some of the questions you asked, and one of them was what major experience has most defined or shaped your life?
That's what we're doing
and,
right now.
Right. So I was thinking about that, and I came up with actually a few. And feminism was definitely there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It was a little later in my life. The first couple were before.
Uh-huh. So what were they?
The first, I think one of the first things that defined me was my parents. Mm-hmm. They were unusual people for where I grew up. I grew up in suburban New Jersey. Mm-hmm. They were, as they would tell me, pink. They weren't red, but they were pink. During the hearings, the House on the 50s, American Activities hearings, my mother watched everything on television. We were the first people in the neighborhood to have a TV. My mother listened to, watched, and mm-hmm, she said, mm-hmm. "Don't tell anybody we're doing this. Mm-hmm. Don't talk about it." Their friends were called up. My father's name was mentioned. This had a big impact on me, that your belief something bad can happen to you. Right. So that had a big major impact on me. Also, my father was a very unusual man, I thought. Mm-hmm. Although I didn't understand it at the time, but he did things like he vacuumed the rug. He made some meals. He would make jam and jelly. Mm-hmm. That was his big thing. He had me washing the car and mowing the lawn.
Mm-hmm.
He was very, very, both my parents are very talented in many ways. Mm-hmm. And he had a shop in his basement, my father. All this was fabulous. I can see it now. And he built things. He built the cabinets in the kitchen. He just built. And my brother across the steps had his little boy shop.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I didn't have anything. So my father took me to his shop and taught me how to use the saw and how to hammer a nail and how to paint a wall. And he taught me all these things as if it was my right to know them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I learned them and I did them. And I always felt like I could do what I wanted to do. And it was very much down to my father. I think my mother never said this, but she would have objected if it wasn't okay with her. So it was definitely something the two of them were doing together.
Mm-hmm. Or she may not have known the implications, but it empowered you.
She was a pretty strong woman.
Yeah.
I would think that she
would have said something.
Yeah, and she, I think she had a lot of conflict about what her roles were also.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
A lot of conflict.
Is your brother older?
He's 14 months older, so not that much older.
Yeah, so his little shop across the way, actually.
Yes.
So I was just thinking, in some ways, you might almost be closer to your father than he was, if that's the way the shop's played out.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was in my father's shop using my father's equipment.
Right,
you know,
right.
My brother had his little mini version. Not that there's any sibling rivalry in my life.
And 14 months would define it.
If you're listening, Mark, this is how I felt.
So that was one of the early, you said there were two experiences early on. That was
very early on. Mm-hmm. And then my father, again, big influence in my life. One thing my father did was, so this is my father's story. I'll tell it very briefly. My father lived in New Brunswick, New Jersey. He went to New Brunswick High School. He graduated in, was it the early 30s, late, whatever. And Rutgers University, which was right there in New Brunswick, was not accepting Jewish students.
Wow.
The principal of New Brunswick High School, the year my father was graduating, said to Rutgers University, "If you don't start accepting Jewish students, I'm not going to let anybody from this high school go to Rutgers."
Wow.
They started accepting Jewish students the year my father graduated. He got into Rutgers.
Wow.
He majored in chemistry. He was Phi Beta Kappa. Mm-hmm. I didn't take after him. Let's just put it that way. Never got close. He graduated. He got his master's in chemistry, and then he couldn't get a job because in the early to mid-30s, they weren't hiring Jewish scientists. Hard to believe with Einstein around, but that was true.
But that was, yeah, that's, that was the way that's it was. Theory and yes. society, and yes. this is practice.
So he did some work for Squibb, which I think probably eventually literally killed him because he worked with DDT and some really bad stuff.
Right.
His father was a tailor, my grandfather. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And my grandfather said, I'm going to open a furrier store. Why don't you come into business with me? So he went into business with his father and his brother. For years, that's what he did. Mm-hmm. My father was a furrier. I would go down to the store, a furrier, fur, dead animals. That's what he did.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I loved my fur coats. Anyway, at some point in the early 60s, a friend of my father's popped into the fur store and said, Lou, you should go back to school. He convinced my father, after 20 years of not studying science, to go check out whether he could go back and get his PhD.
Wow.
My father went to Rutgers one afternoon. It was the summer. It was the one day that the head of the department was in the office because he usually was in Woods Hole on a Cape. He talked to my father and he said, you're in.
Wow.
My father probably had to do a few things. They sold the business, retired my grandfather. My father went back to Rutgers to get his PhD in biochemistry, having not studied for 20 years. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, this mm-hmm. was very unusual in the early 60s for anyone of yep. my father's age to be going back to school. I was in college. My brother was in college. My father was in college. We were all in college. Yep. Back then, though, you know, it was costing me $75 a semester. So it wasn't really a hardship. I was in a state college.
Right, right, right.
My brother was going to Rutgers. So it wasn't too bad. My mother was working. She loved working. So it was fine. My father's in school. He's like acing things. And I'm not because I'm not going to class. But that's besides the point.
Well, you're doing other things.
I'm doing many other things. And my father, I see my father go from the man I loved, always loved, but from black and white to color. I see this man wow. blossom and bloom in a way I didn't know was possible. And my mother, too. My mother loved, she taught kindergarten. Mm-hmm. She loved it. She was creative. Those kids were lucky. Mm-hmm. I saw two happy people working at something they loved. And so the lesson I learned from that was do what you love.
Right.
That has been a big, big, big lesson for me. So I would say early on, my father expected me to do things around, you know, do things around the house, the
be
yard.
Skillful.
Be yeah. skillful and to do something you love. Mm-hmm, they never said that, but I could see. I mean, my father just, he became this whole other guy.
When did you, okay, because my belief, and I think there's some evidence to bear this out, what we do rather than what we say has more impact, but it takes us for a while, like, sometimes years and decades to go back and say what actually happened. When did you discover what you had of value?
I think right away.
Right away. Okay.
I think right away. Yeah. Because then I had to go supposedly get jobs and
right.
it was difficult.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
There wasn't one other incident that I would mm-hmm. say is key in sure. my younger life. In my high school, there was an amazing drama teacher who also taught English. His name was Robert Stevens. He transformed the way we did theater in the school. Mm-hmm. He was beloved by everybody. There's probably 50 yearbooks dedicated to him. he was a phenomenal man. He took me on as student director.
Uh-huh.
And I literally followed that man around taking notes. I followed him around. I learned so much about him. And about theater, just trailing him, that he was also very, very key in my life to develop my, I always loved theater, but he really, really developed my love for theater.
Right. What did you learn from him? What about the way you look at things or
yeah,
people?
You know, I can't put that into yeah. words. Okay. I just learned the value of theater, uh-huh, even though uh-huh. I do theater very differently than he was doing it.
Right.
And I believe the theater I do very differently. I did learn the value of theater. Mm-hmm. I saw its value for me, for my friends. It was very important.
Was he the first person outside your family who let him, who let you study him?
That's a good question.
Because for me, the people who allow me to look closely, I mean, this is the show. The people who allow me to look closely at their lives are giving me a gift that nobody else can. It's the gift of who they are. And when it comes, it comes with a quality of appreciation. We had a voice coach at Union Seminary who had an MFA from Northwestern prior to World War II, and then he came to the seminary after World War II and was the only non-theological faculty there. But they raised an endowment to support him for 30 years or for 25 years after he had faced mandatory retirement age at 65, so he could keep teaching, because he brought people into their own.
Wow.
He brought them into their own by the way in which he saw them, and he allowed them to see him. So,
it's a good question. I think the one thing about Bob Stevens, unfortunately, he died quite young. He died at 55.
Mm-hmm.
He was quite young when he came to school, so we could relate to him.
Mm-hmm.
One thing about him, he was very perceptive. At one point, I was put into an English class with somebody she scared me.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Bob Stevens, who had an English class, who had an advanced English class. And I said, let me in. Please let me in your class. Please. Even though I was not advanced quality at the time, he did. He let me in and he said, okay, this is the project I want you to do. I want you to read George Bernard Shaw. And I want you to write a paper about the women in George Bernard mm-hmm. Shaw's plays. Now, how did he know?
Yeah.
He's the first, he identified that for me. I had no, I mean, nobody else would have known that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I did. And it was amazing.
Yeah.
He had some kind of perception about people that we weren't even aware of.
Right. So, wow. So So
those are my early experiences that were. Then I went to college, mm-hmm. and I was bored, to say the least. I went to a teacher's college,
uh-huh.
because in my generation, you could be a teacher, you could be a nurse, or my mother said, these are my mother's three. I could be a teacher, I could be a nurse, or I could work in Woolworths.
Right, or a bank teller or something like that.
No, not even a bank teller. You could be a teacher or a secretary, a nurse, or work in Woolworths. Right. And I chose teacher because I can't be a nurse, and secretary just didn't appeal to me.
Right.
And I went to a teacher's college. I was bored out of my gourd. There were a couple of classes that I found interesting
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
that were challenging. The rest were boring to me.
Mm-hmm.
What did I do? I went to school from 61 to 65.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I organized the campus.
uh-huh.
We had our first sit-in when a professor was fired, our first demonstration.
Mm-hmm.
Then I got involved in the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement. I brought these two young men from Selma up to the campus to talk. I brought SDS onto the campus.
Mm-hmm,
So that's what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost didn't graduate.
Yes, yes. Don't let boredom rule, because it will find a place to be productive.
You know, I did some other things too. We walked around campus one day. You know, we were bored. There was only one dorm. My second year, I had to commute the first year. My second year, we lived in the dorm. And so we were bored one night. We went around the campus. And we took down all the signs, the parking signs, and we moved them around, and
mm-hmm.
we're a little more creative where we put them.
Right.
That's how bored we were.
Yeah. No, I get it. So you found issues that you cared about. You found a way to kind of engage them. But I want to come back, and I think let's take a musical break. And then come back to the feminism question again, because we're inching our way up to that. What should we play next?
Let's do Alexandra Leaving, because that's what we've got ready.
Okay, very good. And this is Leonard Cohen, Alexandra Leaving.
Not exactly a feminist song. It doesn't matter.
I guess. Well, part of also the feminist thing is it doesn't matter. You like it.
Right. Yeah. I like it. And it's also, for me, this is I've came to this later in life because it's a lot about someone dying and leaving, and I've experienced loss of mm-hmm. parents and grandparents yep. and so on. So that's what this song speaks to me for.
Okay.
Suddenly the night has grown colder. The God of love preparing to depart. Alexandra hoisted on his shoulder. They slip between the sentries of the heart, upheld by the simplicities of pleasure. They gain the light, they formlessly entwine. Radiant beyond your widest measure, they fall among the voices and the wine. It's not a trick, your senses all deceiving. A fitful dream, the morning will exhaust. Say goodbye to Alexandra leaving. Then say goodbye to Alexandra lost. Even though she sleeps upon your satin, even though she wakes you with a kiss, do not say the moment was imagined. Do not stoop to strategies like this, as someone long prepared for this to happen. Firmly to the window, drink it in. Exquisite music, Alexandra laughing. Your first commitment's tangible again. And you who had the honor of her evening, and by that honor had your own restored. Say goodbye to Alexandra leaving. Alexandra leaving with her Lord. Even though she sleeps upon your satin, even though she wakes you with a kiss, do not say the moment was imagined. Do not stoop to strategies like this, as someone long prepared for the occasion, in full command of every plan you write. Do not choose a coward's explanation that hides behind cause and the effect. And you are...
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Sue Perlgut. Sue, you had we'd keep approaching the feminist question in your life? And now I want to go there. I want to stop approaching. So,
even during, I was involved in all these other movements, civil rights mm-hmm. and anti-war. I then moved to New York City. I made that leap. In New York, I was introduced to a woman, Lynn, who then introduced me to street theater and consciousness raising.
And what year was this?
68, 69.
Okay.
Yeah. 68.
Yeah. Yeah.
She introduced me to consciousness raising groups.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I was in one of the witches. They were called witches, mm-hmm. Women's International. Now you can't say that. Terrorist something or other. It was, anyway, we were a consciousness raising group. We weren't terrorists, although maybe.
It was tongue in cheek.
It's possible. Possible the FBI thought we were. Yeah, but so it was consciousness raising where I learned that the personal is political. I had all those aha moments, all these things that I had been thinking. Everything that wasn't working for me in my life came back together. It was amazing because I wasn't like my other friends, that many of them were married. I was living in New York City in the Village on mm-hmm. my mm-hmm. own. Mm-hmm. I was really looking for myself and not finding myself, and found myself in the women's movement, because that's what it was called then,
mm-hmm.
and also in street theater. I joined a street theater company called Burning City Theater.
Wow.
Yes. Yeah. We did political street theater on the streets and in Central Park, and that's what I started doing.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I did other things along the way. I was really finding myself. I had jobs. I would take them. I'd leave them. I just didn't know who I was.
Right. But as you were, I assume you were more or less funding yourself along the way as you were also doing these other more important things.
Yes, I was sort of funding myself. It was a time when one could live in New York City really, 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 really cheaply.
Right.
Really cheaply.
And really kind of.
And you could do what you wanted. This could never happen now. Not even in Brooklyn. Not even in the farthest.
And it couldn't have happened even in the 80s.
No.
It was something that was about that time.
Yes. Yeah. So late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah.
Burning City Theater, I lived in Little Italy around the corner. They had a loft, so we worked in a loft. It was men and women. We did the street theater.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It was amazing. We did tours. We came to Cornell.
Uh-huh.
We actually performed at Cornell in 1972, I think it was. We did an upstate New York tour. Oh, no, I'm sorry. 1969, we did an upstate New York tour. What did we know in February? We came to upstate New York in February. No wonder all these colleges would have us come. We went to Cortland. We went to Cornell. We went to Hamilton. Utica, I can't remember, maybe Syracuse. Yes, Syracuse.
What did you perform? And what was your tour? Did you take on tour?
We took these political theater pieces that we developed that mm-hmm. were talking about the time. We had one on People's Park. Truthfully, I didn't understand half of what we did, but I did it.
Right. You went along.
I went along and I did it. I was one of the drivers because I was a really good driver. I could drive a stick shift. Actually, it was on the wheel shift.
Yep.
It was an experience, to say the least.
And how many of you were in the troupe?
It was a rotating group, so anywhere from probably 8 to 12,
mm-hmm.
all ages,
mm-hmm.
men and women.
For those who don't necessarily know, what is street theater?
Okay, so street theater means you actually do theater on the street.
Yeah, well, it's true literally. Yes,
it's literal. And it's more like guerrilla theater. It's we worked improvisationally.
Mm-hmm.
That time there was the Living Theater. There was the San Francisco Mime Troupe. There was the Bread and Puppet Theater. There were all kinds of theaters. And we all had this loose network. It was called Radical Theater Repertory.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We all did similar kinds of, it was very much the open theater kind of, I don't know if you know about the open theater.
I know, no, you're going to have to explain it to me, but I know some of that because part of my seminary training was in guerrilla theater. in Union Seminary. I don't know if you, well, Union Seminary in New York City in the 1960s, they had a full theater department, a television, a radio. They had all of this stuff because they were wanting to take issues out to the public in a variety of ways. And they also had people who were supportive of guerrilla theater. Tom Driver, who was the theologian who took Paul Tillich's place, was very much strong behind this because these were the rituals that show us how to reflect on our lives.
Wow.
And we make them happen immediately. Wow. And so that's my training. That's my background, along with Bob Seaver, who was the voice coach. And they were at odds with each other because politically they were worlds apart. And but every, you know, but and some of us related to both of them.
Sure, yeah, which was great because you've got the best of both.
Yep.
We did theater that was talking about issues of the time, that very moment.
Right.
That's what we did. And we did it on the streets. We did it. We developed them improvisationally.
And you set up the confrontations or the exchanges or the dialogues based on how you wanted to play the issue.
Yes. And we had different roles. It wasn't like it was improv. When we got to the street, the play was pretty much set.
But you discovered the roles. Play through improvisation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's what we did. Yeah. At the same time, I'm coming to myself as this woman, as this feminist. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking around and I'm thinking, okay, I'm not quite sure what to do with it. In the summer of 1970, the Burning City Theater rented an old camp in New Hampshire. We all decamped. We all went there. Uh-huh. We all left New York, and we all lived on this camp, in this camp, collectively. Ooh, that was an experience. I went there with my boyfriend who was 10 years younger. It was an experience.
And what year again was this?
1970. Okay. The summer of 1970. We used to hitchhike back to the city together. Yep. Oh, if my parents ever knew. I was a nice Jewish girl until I hit New York City. Or maybe before that I wasn't. Anyway, we were invited to perform at this thing called the Festival of Underground Theater in Toronto in the summer of 1970, more like September of 1970. They invited us to do a woman's piece, a woman's play, kind of unheard of. We were really trying to work together as a group in this camp. We couldn't do it. We were falling apart. There was a lot of dysfunction in this group. Unbeknownst to me, I must be very naive, everyone was sleeping with everybody and I didn't have a clue. Women and men and men, women and women. I did a little, what are they called, those grams, those sociograms?
Enneagrams or...
Yeah, and there was all these people, and then there was me.
My sociogram, yeah.
Very bottom, and one couple who didn't participate. Anyway, that's what was going on. We couldn't work together. We just couldn't do theater anymore. It fell apart. Right. However, the women could. We got together as women, and we started to work on a play. We were having a little trouble, and then somebody said, why don't we tell a story from our life? We started to tell stories from our lives, and we put together this phenomenal piece based on stories from our lives, starting with me as a 14-year-old, ending with, we weren't all that old, ending with somebody who was probably 30 who, in her life. Mine was about American Bandstand and my fantasies, and one was about being a single mother, and one was about falling in love with a woman, and one was about having a baby. They were all these stories about who we were, who we are as women. We go as a group to the Festival of Underground Theater, and they're quaking in their boots. Oh my God, a woman's play. They're going to like take off their bras and throw them and scream, I hate men. We perform this piece and it blows everybody away because it's about our lives. And for the first time for me, I experienced what it means to really perform. I was in heaven. It was phenomenal for me. That was why we were performing. The scene was so nutty. I started to have like a little nervous breakdown. Everybody was on drugs, and it was just the wildest scene you could possibly.
Everybody was cutting loose, but you were centering.
And I was centering, so I needed to get out of there.
Yeah.
And we were asked to perform again. I left, and someone I met took my place.
Right.
Told my story. I had to leave. I left, and I won't even go into where I went and what happened when I left because, oh my God. So I left. Eventually, I went back to New York. The whole group disbanded and went back to New York City. And I said to everybody, we performed the Women's Play in New York, I said to all the women, please, could we become a women's theater group? Nope, couldn't do it. So I left the group. And some women who had seen us perform, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, we got together at a place called, I've just blocked the name totally.
That's all right. You can continue with the story.
Okay, we'll anyway, we got to together at Alternate U. It was a Marxist university in a loft on 14th and 6th Avenue.
Alternate U.
Alternate U. Yeah, with a U. It was Alternate
U.
We started to do workshops. And one day, there were 10 of us in the room, and we said, okay, this is it. We are the theater group. Whoever's here, we're the theater group. We're this new women's theater group. I had a friend, Roberta. Mm-hmm. I said, she's joining. We're going to be 11. And we started It's All Right to Be Woman Theater. My theater, my feminism, everything came together at that moment. Mm-hmm. And we started to perform. It took us a while. We did improvisation. We did stories from our lives. We started to perform all around New York City to begin with. We had audiences of 500 people. I thought that's what happened. I thought when you do theater, that's what people come. 500 mm-hmm. people mm-hmm. come. We did theater about everything in our lives, about our childhood. We did theater about, someone did theater about being raped. We did theater about being a woman who had been on drugs. We mm-hmm. did theater about coming out. We did everything we right. could. Right. And women
the
in the
personal
audience.
Was political.
Very, exactly. Women yeah. in the audience were going, oh my God. And women were coming out all over the place.
Yeah, yeah.
It was fabulous. And I did that for 6 years.
Wow. Wow.
6 years. And that was really, for me, that was totally putting everything together moment. I also knew that it was special. I said to myself, this is special, Sue. I was in the moment, which I'm not always in my life at all.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I was in the moment, and I got it, and I enjoyed it, and I embraced it.
Mm-hmm. And then you live beyond it.
And then
the next moment.
What happened was that 1976, we all looked at each other. We did have a split in the group. I did start to make a film about this. It didn't go mm-hmm. very far, but
right.
but people could look on It's All Right to Be Woman. .com. There is a website where mm-hmm. I have a piece of the film. In 1976, we looked at each other and we said, we're done. That's yeah. it. There yeah. was no bad feelings. There was yeah. no, I'm leaving because I hate you. We just looked around and said, we're finished.
Yep. 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 And in many ways, 1976, 5 or 6 was the end of that era.
In a way, because in 1977, I started a feminist bookstore mm-hmm. in the village.
Uh-huh.
I opened a feminist bookstore with a friend. There was a lot still going on.
Yeah, but the tenor changed and people's
yes,
occupations changed.
Yes.
You changed careers.
Yes,
yeah.
I did.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah. I also was able to teach theater, women's theater at Richmond College in Staten Island and Staten Island Community College. I was teaching women's theater in the early 70s. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, yeah.
That's, and then I did go back to school. I went to NYU in 80-81 and got my master's in educational theater
mm-hmm.
and discovered, whoa, people have been doing the stuff we're doing for centuries. I learned a lot about theater history. I loved it. I actually loved mm-hmm. my course. I loved it a lot. I did well in it. It was, you know, I proved to myself I really, if I was interested in something, I could do well in it.
Mm-hmm.
I actually got good grades.
Right.
Which I didn't
so
do in college.
Made peace with that
yes.
part of yourself.
Yep.
Sure.
I did.
Sure.
I did. So I have a master's in educational theater, and I actually used it a little bit.
So where do we go from here? Where do we go from here in terms of your work, your personal life? What?
That basis, that telling stories, mm-hmm. that putting that together mm-hmm. is who I am. I love telling people stories. I like telling my own story, but I love telling people stories. I like helping people tell their stories.
Right.
So my work now, and you know, again, I moved to Ithaca to be with a partner, and of course that didn't work out, as they don't. And then I eventually met the man who became my husband, and we said we'd stay here till his daughter graduated high school. Of course, she's long gone, and we're
and
still,
you're
still here. So there was some. It wasn't an easy transition, but I then discovered that since I like telling people stories, I found the perfect job for myself, which was working for Ithaca Neighborhood Housing Services as their marketing and fundraising person. Huh. And there I could tell people stories about buying homes, about right. being first-time home buyers. And it was great. It was wonderful. I had a little newsletter, had a little TV program. I loved it. When I left there, again, the transition wasn't that easy. In the meantime, I started a senior theater troupe at Lifelong mm-hmm, mm-hmm. where we told stories from our lives. I thought, oh, I've got my theater troupe back. It was all women up until recently. There's a guy in it now. We're way open to having men in it. It's mm-hmm. terrific. We tell stories from our lives, and it's fabulous. Very different when I was young. When I was young, we were running all over the stage. Now we read scripts. Nobody memorizes anything. We're right. pretty staid. However, it's phenomenal to tell stories
from
our
lives.
Well, you're older. I mean, we are older. Yeah, yeah. And memorizing is out. Then I discovered filmmaking, which put it all together for me. Mm-hmm. My business skills, my artistic skills, my storytelling skills, my organizing skills, my ability to work with all kinds of people skills. I feel like with It's All Right to Be a Woman Theater, where this was very special, this is very special for me. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I am making films in a way that is totally and wholly who I am.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
It is cool. I'm very lucky.
Right. And do you want to describe some of the film that you're working on now?
Well, the first film I made was called 101 Ways to Retire or Not. And clearly I became the or not. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The second film I made was called Beets and Beans, Living and Dying with Hospice, which I made because I wanted to give back to hospice. Both my parents were in hospice, and I wanted a way to give back. Mm-hmm. It features.
Did they come up here to hospice?
No, they were in California. They were both in California. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It features our hospice care and a pediatric hospice in Seattle. Mm-hmm. It's a half-hour film. It's very powerful, and lots of people have seen it. Mm-hmm. Then I thought I would work on a film about my theater troupe, but I really couldn't get funding. So there's just this 15-minute piece online. In 2009, my friend Kathy Cook's mother, Connie Cook, died. I knew a teeny bit about Connie, right. Not much. I went to the funeral, to the memorial service, and person after person after person after person talked about this amazing, amazing woman, and my jaw was dropping. Mm-hmm. At the reception, after the memorial part, I said to a bunch of people around me, someone should write a book. No, someone should make a movie. Someone should make a documentary. I mean, you know, that's who I am. And 4 years later, I was given the seed money to mm-hmm, start. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's the film, my most recent film. It's called Connie Cook, a documentary. We've shown it 3 times or 4 times in Ithaca. Mm-hmm. Just came back from the High Falls Film Festival in Rochester. It is going to be shown, I can say this, right? It's going to be shown at Trumansburg High School on December 4th at 7 p.m. The Fantastic, which is a gender equality group, is hosting it. Mm-hmm. We are in the process of showing it. It's about Connie Cook and her work. And Connie Cook decriminalized abortion in New York mm-hmm. State in 1970 as a Republican in the Assembly. It was her bill who did it. She did many, many other things along with that. Mm-hmm. This film mm-hmm. is about her life and her life as an advocate for women's rights, working within the system as a Republican mm-hmm. and the many other things that she did. One of the things we want to do with this film, besides have it seen, is we want young people to see it and discuss it and talk about what they can do as young people or as young women mm-hmm, mm-hmm. to make their lives go in the direction they want to go, to make things happen, because we're going backwards in many ways on women's rights, which is making me an activist once again. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's what we want to do with the films. That's our plan.
Right. I don't know. Well, you brought music from that show.
Yes. Yeah, so
shall we?
The movie, and it's usually a surprise to people, but you're going to get to hear this.
Sure.
Movie ends when Connie worked for a law firm and she finally retired. They wrote a rap about Connie's life. We re-recorded it, and this is a piece of the rap.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and here we go.
Now this is a rap about Connie Cook, with stuff you can't find in any book. Connie was born in Shaker Heights, not a city known for human rights. Cornell was the place for college toil. She made the play with epi and foil. Skill with the sword later puts him in guard. She left many hoist on their petard. She got a LLB back in 43. Sped through in 2 years instead of three. When others were at home serving cookies and tea, Wall Street was where Connie wanted to be.
Then off to Oslo and then to The Hague. Politics ripped her like the plague. So back to America and Ithaca next, which left everyone quite perplexed. Then Al said to Connie,
won't you be my wife and live with me for the rest of my life? And Connie said to Al,
yes, I'll be your wife and I'll live with you for the rest of my life. But I won't obey and I won't submit. And if you think I will, you're full of shit.
Connie Cook, she fought the good fight. Visionary in quest of women's rights. Connie Cook, she fought the good fight. Visionary in quest of women's rights. Connie Cook, she fought the good fight. Visionary in quest of women's rights.
Closing contracts and wills were her lot, but on the back burner stood a political pop. She ran for office in 62. For Connie and her son, the time was due. Then off to assembly, she went with greed. Rocky was on a spending spree. Connie had the health, labor, ways and means, and education, she was keen.
The issue of the day was reproductive choice. To hue and cry, she lent her voice. To the cardinal in the city, this was no good. He said he didn't like where Connie stood. But Connie was a real true diplomat. She knew where the people's votes were at. With the help of the gov and in terrible commotion, Connie was able to carry the motion. When Robeson retired in 74, Connie said to Albany, I'm out the door.
So she thought she'd go to Washington, but then she withdrew and then Matt won.
The gov said, Connie, be my judge.
But the county bar had a bullshit grudge.
The local boy said the court was not her home,
because she had less testosterone.
Connie Cook, she fought the good fight. Visionary in quest of women's rights. Connie Cook, she fought the good fight. Visionary in quest of women's rights.
Her attention was taken by canon law, the outcome of which was something of a draw. To the bishop she seemed the terrible beast, because she was seeking a female priest.
Connie went to Cornell to be a beat,
but academic politics made her weep. Law office is a place she wants to be, but off they go to Tamagami.
Connie Cook, she fought the good fight. Visionary in quest of women's rights. Connie Cook, she fought the good fight. Visionary in quest of women's rights. Connie Cook, she fought the good fight. Visionary in quest of women's rights.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Sue Perlgut. And that was the rap from the documentary on the life of Connie Cook. That's fun.
And
I actually know some of the people who helped put that together, like Sally True and John Hinchcliffe and the
yes.
people at the law firm where
That's
she
right.
where she worked. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
It was Chew Walsh and Miller at the time. That's right. They wrote this rap, which having done all this research on Connie,
sure.
this rap is phenomenal because it really does talk about her life.
Yeah.
Whoever wrote this, those who wrote it, they really understood her and they really got her life in this rap.
Right. And I'm partly because I believe we need to remember the dinosaurs. And by that I mean we need to remember that there were conservative Democrats who were much more damaging and damning than the liberal Republicans of those eras, and progressives existed in both parties.
That's
in very powerful ways, and it's a failure of our imagination and a failure of our political life that we don't have that now. And I just want to, you know, that's, and her life is so very interesting for many of those reasons.
Yes. You know, she ran for Congress in 1984. I was in Ithaca at the time, and I can't remember, you know, I know many people had the same thing. Should I vote for her because she was a woman, or should I vote for Matt McHugh because he was a Democrat?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember what I did, but those were that was the kind of, yep. Oh my gosh, what do we do? Because she was much more progressive on women's rights than he was at mm-hmm. that point.
Mm-hmm. And she also, one of the things that, there were many doors that were opened for really reconsidering gender roles that were not walked through. And with the legalization of abortion in New York State in 1970 and the beginnings of that in 1969 and the groups of clergy and other people who were helping to create supportive groups around that issue, we never actually walked through the reconsideration of gender roles in this culture, and we never have. And this is unfinished business in some very profound ways. And it's neat to see you're bringing her life back out because it helps us take that on.
Yes. And this is, you know, I've been, I mean, this is a very much issue for United States is mm-hmm, this reproductive mm-hmm. rights.
And for the world.
It doesn't, and for the world too. It doesn't take away from all the horrible things are happening to women all over the world. The terrible ways in which women mm-hmm. are murdered or disfigured or raped or enslaved. It doesn't take away from all that. It's just a piece of this. And for me, activism means one identifies this as something to be activist about, but understands all these other things that are going on too.
Right. And right, and while you can identify a problem, you have to work with it in a way that allows for addressing evil without demonizing any of the actors.
Well,
because it gets hard. It gets hard. I mean, it gets hard to work with people once you've written them off the face of the earth.
Sometimes, yes, yeah. And I think it's one of my failings. Yeah. I spoke to a group of young women at Ithaca High School. They asked me how I felt about the abortion protesters across the street from Planned Parenthood mm-hmm. here in Ithaca. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, I'm not the one to go talk to these people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I can't. I just scream at them. Mm-hmm. I haven't gotten beyond
right.
that. So there's
you're not
a
the
part
one to
of
do
me.
That job.
Yes,
right.
There's
right.
a part of me that just there's certain people mm-hmm. and I have nothing to say to them and I don't want to talk to them.
Mm-hmm. And there are those on that side who have exactly the same.
That's right. That's right. And I'm
reaction.
Afraid that I'm one of them.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's really too bad, but that's who I am.
No, I get it. I live my life in the middle and you get shot from all sides. So that's.
I can be in the middle.
No, I know.
But not on this issue.
Yeah. That's exactly.
It's like, whoop.
You were going to mention some work that you're doing
right.
now.
So, you know, who I am now is that you know, I'm retired. I make films. I lead the senior theater troupe, mm-hmm. which is performing stories from our lives. We pick a theme, and this theme for this particular play is physical appearance. It's a trip.
Uh-huh.
We're performing at the library, the Tompkins County Library, December 3rd at 5:30 in the Borg Warner Community Room. We're also performing at the Open House of Lifelong on December 9th, but I don't have a time.
Mm-hmm,
you have to check out the Lifelong website or the calendar. So we're doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also on the board of Cinemopolis and this whole other hat that I wear. Mm-hmm. At the moment, I'm chair of our county's tourism board,
mm-hmm.
which is a whole other hat. Yeah. However, I bring who I am to that role. So I feel like nothing has changed for me. I am who I am. I am who I've always been, with more wisdom, with more understanding, maybe with more tact, maybe not.
Right. But but probably more acceptance of whether it's tactful or not.
Yes.
And less self-doubting.
Yes.
That kind of leads to the next question, which I'd like to close the show with, which is, what do you do to renew yourself intellectually, emotionally, and physically on a regular basis, daily, weekly, monthly? What do you do to notice when things are kind of going off kilter and to bring them back?
I one thing I do is I do yoga. I do chair yoga twice a week with Jai Hari, who actually was one of the people who sang the rap. She and her husband, John Meyerhoff, who are in Answer the Muse. They are the raps. They are the rappers. I was saying to this young man, so I have these singers. He said, no, Sue, they're rappers. I was like, oh, yes, I have these rappers. So I do yoga, which is very definitely brings me, you know, really centers me, brings me back. I read a lot of murder mysteries. That's my hobby. And I can, you know, I actually sort of semi look forward to those snowy winter days because I have a no guilt on the couch, read a murder mystery. I don't have to leave the house.
It's an open invitation to stay home.
Absolutely. Yep. That's what I do. What else do I do for fun? I'm in different groups of women. I'm in a book club. I meet with different groups of women doing various things. I go out to dinner and lunch with friends. My husband and I love to go to movies and the theater. We do a lot of that. We, as much as we can, we hang out with our granddaughter, which isn't too much because she lives far away. So that's, and be with friends. That's really what I do.
And the one that seems like it's almost a more scheduled constant of those is the yoga.
Yes.
And one of the things, and is that something that you schedule on a daily basis?
Yeah, it's two times a week.
Two times a week.
Yep. Yeah. I'm in a writing group too. Right. So I do plenty of things.
Right. And I guess what I want to know is, does your life just roll along? Or how do you know? I mean, I'm asking it in kind of a silly way because you have described a very wonderful kind of the letting the river flow. But some people know when they need to step back because they see things happen in their lives. What tells you that you need to take care of yourself?
When I start to feel ill, I just came through a few days of vertigo. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, just sit down. Sit down, cancel every appointment.
That's the bad rolling experience. Yes.
Yes. Yes. So unfortunately, that's how I listen to myself. Mm-hmm. If something tragic happens in my life, I also
stop.
I know. Yeah. And I say, okay, I got to stop. I have to do what I have to do about this. I'm a pretty positive person. I have my moments, definitely. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, my life has been... has had a lot of ups and downs and still does because I'm alive and I'm breathing and I'm functioning.
Yeah.
That's true, I think, of most people.
Right. And you described yourself in that time with the group that went off to live in New Hampshire as they were all having sex with each other and you were kind of on the periphery in a way that was clueless, but you're not so clueless.
I'm a little naive.
But
still.
So how have you learned to carry that? Because being clueless is a wonderful way to have a naive mind, but it's also at times heart wrenching because you realize you didn't know what was going on.
Right.
And how have you learned to live with that quality?
I've had to just accept. I've had some very bad experiences because I've allowed some people in my life that if I were really paying attention, they never would have walked through the front door.
Right.
I've had to go through whatever it is one goes through to get over those experiences.
Yes.
Accept them, mourn them, rail at them, whatever it is. And those are very hard and difficult times.
Curse the sky.
Yes.
No, I get it. Sue, thank you for sharing your life.
Oh, you're welcome.
And
it's a good life. I think retirement's great. I just want to say that.
Yeah. 101 ways to retire or not.
That's right.
Yes, I get it. We're going to close with a recap of the wrap.
Thank you. Thank you, Eric.
Take care. Thank you.
Now this is a wrap about Connie Cook. With stuff you can't find in any book. Connie was born in Shaker Heights, not a city known for